Hello, welcome to 8.9 Newsweek. I'm Finlow Costain. Do we seriously need to chop down more trees to address the climate crisis? Paul Brannan, the author of Timber! How wood can help save the world from climate breakdown? Well, he thinks so. What about food? Is it possible to make a living from a third of an acre of land? I speak to US lean microfarmer and author Ben Hartman. And in a world struggling with antimicrobial resistance, what's the WHO doing downgrading a whole class of antibiotics? Dr. Laura Higham shares her concerns. Well, that's all later. But first, what about my farm? Regenerative agriculture? Well, it's a great idea, but it'll never work here. Tim Williams has managed pasture-based dairy systems, large-scale regenerative beef finishing and breeding units, and worked on regenerative organic arable systems. I spoke to Tim recently about some of the challenges and misconceptions surrounding regenerative agriculture, and I started by asking what attracted him to this sort of farming in the first place.
Well, I guess it's kind of my background's in pastoral farming in New Zealand. So I grew up on a sheep and beef farm. And then I kind of moved into organic systems. And then when I came to the UK, I was working in organic systems over here, arable and livestock, but still had that thing of grassland management and just kind of pushing the boundaries around pasture management and what you can actually achieve with that. And then understanding, like moving on to mob stocking and actually understanding how that functions. And I've managed a farm in New Zealand. And during that time, we're running about 800 head of cattle, all on rotation, all behind electric fencing. And we're finishing about 250 head of cattle annually.
Tim, you mentioned organic there, and a lot of people ask about the difference between organic and regenerative. How would you summarize the difference?
Well, I think the thing about regenerative is that it's a journey, and it's about constantly improving. So you're either regenerating a system or you're degenerating a system. And I think the thing about some conventional systems is that they're regenerative, some are degenerative. And it's the same with organic systems as well. You know, you can have quite degenerative organic systems, but you can have quite regenerative organic systems. And I think it's about understanding that it's a journey, you're on that progression, so you're constantly looking to improve. And I don't think it really matters if you're conventional or organic, you can still apply those same principles.
Now, you've been working with Wild Farmed on their regenerative wheat program. How does regenerative wheat differ from mainstream wheat production?
Yeah, so I was one of the sort of the initial growers for Wild Farmed, and we were invited to join them to develop their growing standards. And one of the things we looked at were inputs, and particularly the reduction of nitrogen use. And then we kind of came up with the grower standards. And it's around sort of reducing those inputs and nutrition on need. And I think the real critical factor in their system is the focus on biology rather than chemistry. And I guess that's the same with any sort of regenerative system. Once you get your biology working for you, then you can start removing those inputs. So I think that's kind of that key critical understanding of, or differentiation between a conventional system is very much chemistry focused, whereas a regenerative system should essentially be biological focused.
And within that, you increasing field diversity and integrating livestock too.
So they use blends. So there's a diversity within that system, and they do intercropping as well. So growing peas and wheat and things. And so the idea around it is trying to incorporate as much diversity into the system as possible, which is challenging in a monoculture. The other element is strip tilling into living mulches as well. So, and even like the ultimate, and this is where Andy came from initially, was trying to put an annual system into a perennial system, and that strip tilling and that mowing allows that. And that understanding that how can we develop a complex plant community whilst only growing one crop. So there is a lot of diversity in that system, and that's what they're working on. The livestock element is about bringing livestock through. So if you're grazing off your cover crops and bringing that added dimension into the system. I think the thing with livestock in an arable system as well, where it's a little bit challenging, and it's also about context, is it's the essence of livestock. So it's not necessarily hooves on the ground, but actually adding that biological element. So whether that's through a compost tea or a compost extract, and you can make that compost through the use of manures and things like that. So it's not necessarily having hooves on the ground, but getting that element of livestock into the system.
And of course, in the UK, there tends to be a split between livestock in the West and arable in the East. So it must be difficult sometimes to find livestock to bring into a regenerative arable system.
It is, but there seems to be quite a nice marriage happening now between shepherds with flocks of lambs, and there's kind of a matchmaking service now where you can match arable farms with livestock managers. And I don't think it's kind of that collaborative mindset where you're working with other farmers to enhance each other's systems, really. And I think that's part of the regenerative system as well.
Now, you've spent several years as a regenerative farming advisor. What do you say when people tell you it'll never work on my farm?
Well, first thing I do is ask them why they think it wouldn't work. Why do you think it's not going to work? Because the thing about a regenerative system is it's not a trend. It's actually how the system actually works. You know, it's the understanding this is how we know now, this is how soil functions. And so you can't say it's not going to work on my farm because you're putting these practices and principles in place that allow natural processes to happen. I think the sort of the nuance to that is it's about context. So when people say, you know, I can't run livestock on my farm, then that's fine. Then we look at ways of adapting that sort of principle to that context, and working with it in that context, I think, is really important.
What other common issues do you come across?
On the farm, I think there's a lot of, one of the biggest issues I see on farms is infiltration and lack thereof. And after the winter that we've just had, I think it's so critical now. I've dug holes on farms where you're digging down and you're 2 inches down and the ground's almost dry, whereas on top it's absolutely saturated. And so just improving those infiltration rates and getting that air and that water into the system, because then 6 months down the track, in the middle of July, everyone's going to be saying that we're in a drought. And, you know, so that's a real critical factor. And I think if we can change that up, and also one of the things that I'm seeing more and more of is actually the biological profile and the bacterial dominance within soils, and how we can shift that towards that more balanced bacterial to fungal ratio so that these soils are more open and more aerated. And it's about returning, you know, getting that understanding about those bacterial to fungal ratios and how we can enhance that through diversity and through feeding back into the system with plant material.
Now, a lot of farmers have spent decades trying to simplify their systems. So how do they respond to the idea of increasing or re-establishing complexity and biological diversity on their farms?
I think it's about understanding the system. And this is why livestock are really quite helpful, because if you want to increase that complexity, put in a complex herbal lay for a few years, extend those rotations out, get those plants growing, and then that will naturally enhance that below ground complexity. And even now with the support payments, I know SAM3 is quite a good support payment. You don't necessarily need to even have the livestock there in order to develop that system as well. It's just having that complex plant community that can shift that ratio. You know, I've seen bacterial to fungal ratios of like 0.01, 0.02. And you can't operate a natural biological system with that much bacterial dominance. And then it's obviously it compounds, you're going compounds one way. If we can compound the other way, then you see these benefits.
Now that the term regenerative farming is becoming much better known, are you generally happy with the way that it's being adopted, or do you think that there are some misconceptions forming about what it actually means and the level of transition necessary?
Well, there's a really interesting paper. I don't know if you've come across it. It's called The Levels of Regenerative Agriculture. And it talks about this progression from sort of functional right up to this sort of evolutionary sort of element. And we're still very much on this functional level where we're looking at cover crops and mob stocking and all these sort of practices and principles. But it's about that evolution and understanding what that next level means. And I think by replacing the plow with glyphosate, for example, you're not, unless you're moving along that journey of regeneration, you know, I sort of said about degeneration versus regeneration, unless you're moving up that sort of continuum, then you're not truly regenerating your system. And so we can replace these principles and practices like conventional systems with more regenerative practices. But unless we're seeing that increase in overall system health, then is that system truly regenerative?
While a truly regenerative system is embedded in those principles, do you think that an early focus on practices can actually be helpful for farmers who spend a lot of their lives delivering against much more prescriptive system requirements?
I think it's about showing, either demonstrating through sort of peer-to-peer learning how it can be done, but also empowering farmers to actually lead. And so the way I would approach it is that I would go in and I'd assess the farm and assess the system health and say, look, these are your limitations to production, and give them that information and say, you could do this or you could do this. It's entirely up to you how you then proceed. And I think empowering people and giving them the knowledge and the understanding and the skills will create that shift rather than carrot stick process.
And just finally, thinking about communicating regeneration to customers, do you think that the fact that there isn't a commonly accepted definition of regenerative farming is a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of greenwashing out there. I've got background in marketing as well, and it's kind of, you know, it's a marketer's dream basically, because it answers so many questions. You know, there's so many benefits to the system, and so to be selling that, obviously it attracts a premium and it's a great marketing tool. I think the key is being able to demonstrate that it actually is regenerative. And so these sort of you've got the Savory Institute with their ecological outcome verification, you know, you've got Soil Mentor, which is a really good tool to be able to show that you're actually making these improvements. I think the market really needs to understand that it's actually an outcomes-based situation, and understanding what those outcomes should be. And if you can demonstrate those outcomes, then sure, it is a regenerative system. But you can't just say we're regenerative.
That was regenerative farming advisor Tim Williams. A new book, Timber! How Wood Could Help Save the World from Climate Breakdown, will be published later this year. It's by Paul Brannan, the Director of Public Affairs for the European Confederation of Woodworking Industries, who says that planting trees is not enough to prevent the climate crisis. We also have to chop them down. I asked him what he means.
Well, I know it sounds alarming, but the context is we're facing climate breakdown, and there's two big things we need to do, and we need to do them simultaneously. So one is we need to reduce our emissions of carbon into the atmosphere, and we also need to remove carbon from the atmosphere. And trees are fantastic at removing carbon from the atmosphere. So while they're growing in the forest, their process of photosynthesis means they're taking in the CO2 and they're storing it. And they're great at that. But they have a life cycle. And early in their lives, they take in a little bit. In middle age, they take in a lot. And when they reach old age, they slow down considerably, stop taking in the CO2, and eventually will die, fall over, and release the CO2 back into the atmosphere, which is what we don't want. So by harvesting, felling the trees as they reach the end of middle age, and taking the timber, which continues to store the carbon, and moving that timber into the built environment, then we are able to go on storing the carbon that was stored in the forest. Mm. And the key thing is that we obviously need to replant or allow natural regrowth of the forest once we fell the trees, so that our forest stock stays as high as it currently is and ideally expands. And I'm very much talking in the book about the European context and the North American context. I'm not talking about South America and the rainforest. I'm talking about northern forests and how we need to use them in the same way as a farmer does. You know, no one complains when the farmer harvests at the end of the year the wheat crop. No one protests about that, saying save the wheat, because it's a renewable, sustainable process. It will be planted again the following year. Forests are on a longer time scale. We're talking 30, 40 years before we fell, harvest, and then replant. But that's the process. And as a result of this, we should be able to increase the amount of carbon stored in timber in the built environment to the extent that in 30, 40, 50 years' time, we could have as much carbon stored in the timber in the built environment of our cities as we do in the forests that surround our cities.
When you're talking about forests, I'm imagining plantations. Are we talking mostly about conifers, or are there deciduous trees as well?
Both in the European context and both in the North American context. I think in the UK context, we're talking primarily here about conifers. So we're talking about the likes of Kielder Forest in Northumberland up on the Scottish border, a man-made forest planted predominantly after the Second World War. Growing relatively quickly compared to the deciduous trees. So yes, you could call them plantation forests. We don't tend to talk about them in that way in the UK, but a man-made planted forest of conifers. And in the UK at the moment, there's roughly a 50-50 split between conifers and deciduous. But we do use our hardwoods, maybe not as much as we could. And certainly in the likes of Germany and Austria, they're using their hardwoods. Particularly in the furniture industry. But for most of the construction purposes where the bulk of timber goes, it's the softwoods, it's the conifers that we need and we will need more of going forward.
Well, let's think about construction for just a moment, which is to what extent can timber actually replace concrete and steel in the built environment? I mean, in terms of scale, are we likely to be constructing the equivalent of the Severn Bridge from timber anytime soon?
Well, good question. If you look at the United States, Canada, Scotland, most of the Nordics, in most places in the Nordics, then 80% plus of family homes are timber frame. That's the structural material. Weirdly, in England, it's the other way around. More than 80% are not timber framed. So the family house in the suburban and rural area can be built with a timber frame as the structural material. So it's happening and we need to do it more, particularly in England. Now, if we move into the cities where housing is denser, buildings are bigger, there has been a tendency in the last 100 years for the dominant material to be concrete and steel. And until relatively recently, timber wasn't able to replace that, but it is now. And the reason for that is we have a material known as engineered timber in Europe or mass timber in the United States, which is a kind of grown-up version of plywood where you stick the pieces of wood together at right angles and you can create a material, could be cross-laminated timber or laminated veneered lumber or glue lam. And these materials have the structural strength of steel and concrete. And as a result, we are able to build at height and scale with timber. So in 2009, in London, we had Murray Grove, which was a cross-laminated timber building, first engineered timber building in London, and that went up to 9 stories. And now Norway, Austria, they've gone up to 18 stories with engineered timber. So we can now build big buildings out of timber. So probably we won't be building in the near future bridges, but the vast majority of the built environment, certainly up to 20, 30 stories, can now and in future be built from timber.
That's interesting. Now, a lot of architects, of course, seem to value big, tall buildings from Canary Wharf to London's Gherkin, which are certainly higher than 20 stories. Do you think that we need to start reconstructing our expectations of building scale and indeed our conception of built beauty?
To some extent, I think the context here is this expanding global population. I mean, in 2020, what did we have? We had, 6 billion people? And we're now up to 8 billion by 2050. Now, most of those people will live in an urban environment, and many of them will live in one of the big super cities. I mean, in the case of the UK, we're talking London. That is our premier city with a fast, still with an expanding population. And we have a kind of choice, really. Either we're going to house them by building buildings which spread out into the countryside and eat into the greenbelt, or we go up. And I think a lot of us, myself included, would favour we need to have more people living in taller buildings going forwards. Now, I think to some extent, the over 20, over 30 stories is a bit of a red herring. That'll always be a minority of the population living in the very tall buildings. Most people in future will live in a mid-rise build in our cities, particularly the super cities. So we're talking about 8, 10, 15, 20 stories. And wood is perfectly capable of delivering that.
Just taking a step back and thinking about supply, is all this timber going to come from forests? I'm wondering to what extent recycling can play its part.
Well, it's a combination of where it will come from. And part of the reason for writing the book was this was a question that was coming up more and more. I was finding that if you make the case for building more with wood, then people get it. They get the climate benefits. And then they ask, but is there enough wood? And the scale of which we could expand the use of wood construction, and in particular, the use of wood fiber insulation. All of our buildings need to be better insulated, both for the winter to do with the cold, but also increasingly for the summer to do with the heat. That insulation at the moment is predominantly fossil fuel based. So we need to switch into a nature-based material, and wood fibers are absolutely ideal for that. So when we're talking about two massive increases in the need for wood, one to build with and two to insulate with. So where's it going to come from? So our forests in Europe have been expanding. So there is a growing sustainable wood supply in a European context. So that's good news. In the UK, we've been standing still, very slow progress on planting any more, both particularly planting more commercial wood in the UK. Although there is political support for it, it seems difficult to do. So we've got to unlock that somehow so we can expand our forest cover. We need to use better, more efficiently, the wood that we already have. I visited a sawmill in northern France recently. They're using X-ray machines. They're using CT scans to optimize how to cut the wood so that we can maximize the timber coming out of each of the tree trunks. So there's that material efficiency. We need to build better by using less wood. So we mustn't over-specify. Don't build a great big thick wooden wall if a thinner wooden wall would do, in simple terms. But yes, we need to reuse wood. We've had the first building go up in London recently, which has been designed to be disassembled and reused. So design for reuse, very important. Coming, more of that will come through. And ultimately, we need to recycle more wood. We do quite a lot of recycling of wood. It varies from country to country. The Italians are excellent at it. We in the UK are fairly good, but could be better. And that recycled wood can go into new wood products. So you take an existing wood product, you recycle it, and you can make particularly panels. So if you think of furniture from IKEA, that kind of chipboard material can be made entirely from recycled wood. So recycling will also be important as well.
Now, just finally, there's such a demand for land in places like the United Kingdom. How do you think we balance the need for timber with the need for good food and indeed space for nature?
Again, this was part of the reason for writing the book, was because there is a tendency to think it's an either or. So if we plant more trees, that means we'll have less farmland, therefore means we'll have less food. And it absolutely doesn't need to be like that. There are multiple win-wins we can exercise here. So, for example, that issue of do we grow food or do we grow trees? Growing body of evidence falling under the title agroforestry is that you can insert up to 10% trees on farmland and still produce the same amount of food from that land. And you can do that with both animals and with crops. It's not just happening in the UK, albeit slowly, it's happening in Europe and it's been happening in Australia as well. So there's various examples in the book of how we can still maintain the level of food production we have and increase the amount of trees that we plant. The other win-win is wherever you do put trees, you increase biodiversity. So if you put more trees on farms, you'll have more biodiversity on farms. And we don't have to do these trade-offs necessarily between biodiversity and wood production, or between wood production and food production. We can do them simultaneously. And what we really do need here, particularly in England, is we need a land use strategy. because at the moment we're dealing with issues in silos, which is absolutely not the way to approach things. And we need to look at things in a cross-cutting way. Scotland has a land use strategy, and it really is time that England now had a land use strategy too.
Paul Brannan, the author of Timber. While progress has been made to reduce the use of routine antibiotics in animal agriculture, there is now a fear that a recent decision by the World Health Organization to change the way that it classifies macrolides could be taken as a green light for their increased use. Dr. Laura Higham is a veterinary consultant for FAI Farms. I asked her what macrolides are and what's changed.
Yeah, so macrolides are a class of antibiotic widely used in human and animal medicine. And they have been classified by the World Health Organization prior to February this year as being a what's called a highest priority critically important antibiotic. And in February, this list that the World Health Organization published downgraded macrolides from being HPCIAs, as we call them, down to critically important antibiotics. Now, this list that the World Health Organization publishes is regularly refreshed to reflect evidence of which medicines we should be preserving as highly important to human medicine and which pose a threat when they're used in animals in terms of the potential emergence of pathogens that could cause a threat to human health. And so this list was refreshed in February this year. And the major change, as we see it at FAI, is the downgrading of macrolides to being a critically important antibiotic.
And this is to do with the danger for human beings of overuse and therefore the increased level of resistance to antibiotics?
That's right. And there's no change in that per se, in that macrolides, when used in animals, they present a risk of emergence of resistant foodborne pathogens, for example, Campylobacter. But what has changed is, after consultation, the World Health Organization have concluded that actually these Campylobacter infections, although they're quite prevalent, they're not necessarily life-limiting or particularly serious for people in the vast majority of cases. So they're generally considered to be self-limiting and often don't actually require usage of an antibiotic in a human patient. However, what concerns at FAI is not necessarily this evidence, which is obviously very well backed by the World Health Organization and partners and various consultants, but the fact that there may be unintended consequences of this downgrade in the classification of macrolides. We know that macrolides are used fairly extensively in animal health settings, and they're really important for animal health and welfare, that's for certain. But there is a potential risk, as we see it at FAI, that this represents, or this could be read as a green light to certain organisations and producers to use macrolides more regularly and potentially in various global settings for the prevention of infections.
So just to go back to basics, why is it important to end the routine use of antibiotics on farms?
Yeah, the basic response would be, of course, that we need to be limiting the emergence of resistance organisms for both human and animal health and also environmental health. Antimicrobial resistance is the quintessential one health issue, in that it can emerge in human and animal individuals, but it can circulate within the environment and have unintended consequences to environmental organisms as well, and enter what's called the resistome, this kind of ongoing cycle of resistance determinants, be they resistant bacteria or resistance genes, through the pool of animals, people and environmental organisms, and present an ongoing global threat to human and animal health. So this is the primary concern, is that overuse and long-term use of antibiotics, be that in a treatment, a metaphylactic, a prophylactic, which means prevention, or even growth promotion type context, all of these uses can foster antimicrobial resistance. So it's absolutely paramount that we see these as very vital, almost like non-renewable resources that we need to protect in order to protect One Health, essentially. The other reason, of course, is that the prevention of infection potentially masks ongoing and underlying problems with a production system, with a husbandry system, with a set of management practices, with a set of breeds that are used in production, all of those things. And so we don't want to be masking those issues. We want to actually be unearthing them and addressing them in a more sustainable way.
And how much progress has actually been made in Britain, but also globally?
Yeah, the progress against antimicrobial usage has has been really, really promising and actually really commendable, particularly in the UK sectors. So the recently published Veterinary Antibiotic Sales and Surveillance Report that's regularly published by the Veterinary Medicines Directorate shows that actually we've had a 59% reduction in antimicrobial use in farmed animal species in the UK between 2014 and 2022, which is of course more than half usage is slashed, and that is fantastic, and due to the efforts of many animal sectors and also the likes of Ruma and their targets task force, which has really drilled down on how we reduce that usage and put in place reasonable targets. Across the world, the picture is also similarly commendable, although a slightly lower level in reductions. For example, the World Organization for Animal Health charted a 13% reduction between 2017 and 2019 across the vast majority of countries across the world in animal sectors. And similarly, a European study showed a 21% reduction in usage in farmed animals between 2017 and 2019. So those more recent figures chart a slightly lower reduction, but really, again, good progress, especially against the backdrop of peer-reviewed papers that did suggest we were going to be looking at much greater increases in usage of antibiotics across food animals. But just to caveat that progress, that is of course based on the data that we have available. So as long as that data is relatively robust, then we've got a good picture in front of us. But what we would say is that we really don't need to be taking our foot off the pedal in terms of this progress. There is plenty of occasions and incidences of injudicious antibiotic use across the human and animal sectors that we still need to focus on, and there's lots of work that remains to be done.
Now, managing disease risk is presumably at the heart of continuing antibiotic use. So what are the alternatives to routine medications?
Yeah, so at FAI, we often embed what we describe as the three R's of antimicrobial stewardship into the policies that we draft for our clients across the food sectors in the UK and in global food supply chains. This stands for reduce, replace and refine. And it's in line with, of course, the traditionally used 3Rs principles that was historically used in animal usage and experimentation. But we've reused it for the problem of antimicrobial stewardship, and it's been really helpful and effective at sort of providing a framework for reduction and stewardship. So the first one, of course, is reduce, and that would involve removing sort of the incidences of unnecessary use of antibiotics. Again, routine prophylactic and group treatment, and reducing the use of highest priority critically important antibiotics that is broadly supported to be in line with antimicrobial stewardship in terms of preserving those antibiotics for human health. Refine, let's whip to the last one, but refine is all about those instances where we know that antibiotic usage in an animal is really necessary to protect their health and welfare. And in that case, it'd be all about sort of complying with the veterinary prescription in terms of route, dosage, frequency, withdrawal period, storage and disposal methods, and making sure that compliance in that animal setting is bang on in line with that prescription as per veterinary advice. And then the one that perhaps we're getting at here is all about replace. And this one is perhaps a little bit more systemic, in that sometimes we'll see antibiotic usage as a red flag for an underlying problem, and so in those cases we might look to the production system and the practices that are deployed in that setting, and look at things like herd health planning and flock health planning. Do we have the right vaccinations in place? Do we have the right hygiene, the right building maintenance, and the right building structures to ensure animal health and welfare?
And presumably breed comes into that as well.
Exactly, yeah. So the next one would certainly be looking at robust, high welfare breeds. There's lots of evidence that the slower growing breeds, when they're used in Scandinavia, has been accompanied by a drop in antibiotic usage. So those birds are potentially healthier and in a higher state of welfare, which then leads to less stress and sort of better production outcomes in terms of antibiotic use, as well as welfare outcomes too. And that could be translated across a number of different species too. We might look at, again, lower stress production systems, look at things like stocking density, look at things like early weaning in certain species. Are those things appropriate and can we change them? And then at the end, something a bit more, perhaps a bit more systemic again, is looking at the production system itself. At FAI, we, of course, have lots of regenerative agriculture programs, both on our own farm in Oxford and also within the supply chain of our clients. And we see in those settings that that classically antibiotic usage is very low. And that's also supported by other agroecological systems within peer-reviewed publications that suggest that systems like organic are generally associated with much lower levels of antibiotic usage compared to some of the indoor and more intensive animal settings. So we might look at introducing those sorts of principles, agroecological principles, in discussions with producers and food supply chains. So all in all, the replace principle is perhaps looking more at the root causes and perhaps making quite substantial changes.
And Laura, just finally, AI seems to be being touted as providing hope that new antibiotics may be discovered. Is this hope real?
I think AI and sort of new mechanisms for discovering new antimicrobial molecules are exciting, and they're very interesting. Of course, we do need a new pipeline of antimicrobials to serve better human and animal health and environmental health too. So that's without doubt something that needs to be investigated. But what does concern me is the idea of sort of silver bullet solutions. We need to get better at preserving and managing and stewarding our existing antimicrobial arsenal, our toolbox that we already have. We've seen a demise in the efficacy of virtually all of the antibiotics that are in use across the animal and human settings. That's just natural. It's natural selection. But we are, although we've made progress certainly in managing those resources, we do need to get more competent in that across all health spheres. And so what concerns me is that with the discovery and the marketing and the commercialization of new molecules, that they will undergo the same threats and undergo the same process that we've seen with all of our existing antibiotics, in that they'll of course be subject to resistance in the supply chains, certainly of animals, but also in human medicine too. So I do think we need to get better at that alongside these routes for new discovery.
Dr. Laura Higham from FAI Farms. In the early 1970s, US Agriculture Secretary Earl Bunt infamously commanded farmers to get big or get out. Ben Hartman considered the suggestion disastrous, and in his book, The Lean Micro Farm, he shows how small, hyper-local farms can be both ecologically and economically superior to industrial-scale operations geared towards export and commodity markets. I spoke to Ben Hartman, and I started by asking him just how big his farm is and what he produces.
Our farm is one-third of 1 acre, 15,000 square feet. Our main products our baby cut greens, arugula, spinach, salad mix, that sort of thing, and tomatoes. We have a box scheme, and so we sell diversified, we grow a diversified range of crops from onions to carrots and everything in between also.
Now, Ben, you started out with an acre, but then chose to downsize to just a third of an acre. How difficult was that process?
Well, the decision was relatively easy to make. The implementation quite difficult, but the rewards, the payoffs have been huge. We made that decision largely because we had two young kids. We were farming full tilt, 50, 60 hours a week, and realized that we needed to make something had to change if we were going to maintain our sanity through these young childhood years. And also, it was an opportunity to apply. We've been using the lean system, just started using the lean system on our farm, and realized that there are just huge potentials to this new way of thinking, this no waste way of thinking about farming. So it was an opportunity to build a farm from the ground up using lean systems and thinking. And the rewards for us have been that we now earn as much income as we did on that larger scale farm. Even though we drastically shrunk the size of our farm, we sell all of our food within a mile and a half of the farm. All of our inputs, our fertilizer in the form of compost comes from within a mile and a half of the farm.
And how did you build up your customer base? Were they people that you already knew, or were you starting from scratch?
About half were people we knew and about half were new customers. And what we did was relied on Google Maps to give us a printout of everyone who potentially could buy food from us within a few miles of the farm. We're at the edge of a city of about 40,000 people, a small college town in Indiana, not necessarily a foodie destination. But we just had to check assumptions at the door, and have some and do some research. And so one of our longest running accounts is actually a donut shop, sells our lettuce and tomatoes on their lunch menu. And what we did was search those customers who are closest to our farm and who would be able to pay us living wages and who might order in sufficient volume from us. And of the 60 or so potential customers, we chose just 4 or 5 that we deliver to on a regular basis. So we're very choosy with our customers and who we sell to. And that helps keeps our margins to where we can make a living wage for our work.
Thinking about the farm itself and your way of working, are you able to recycle the nutrients that you have in your soil, or are you dependent on chemical fertilizers?
Well, yeah, like I said, all of our inputs come from within a mile and a half of the farm. And that's in the form of leaves from oak and maple trees, mostly, from around our farm. And we partner with some landscape companies in the city to drop those raw materials off on our farm. We make a big heap, turn them 2 or 3 times. It's very rough, you know, crude compost. And then we'll put 4 inches of it on the soil surface, what we call the deep mulch method. Don't till it in. We don't even own a tiller that we use here, and simply grow into the compost. We have the benefits of weed smothering, long-term fertility, excellent tilth, and of course, low or actually no cost for our fertility.
Now, you've mentioned tomatoes and lettuces. Are you essentially running a micro row crop system, or is there a more three-dimensional element as well?
Well, it's not exactly row crop because we use a bed system to grow our food. Our beds are 1 meter in width and about 50 meters or so in length. And the main difference between what we do in a row cropping system would be the nimbleness with which we make our decisions. We have 50 some beds on our farm, and so we're constantly swapping those out, growing 2 or 3 crops this season, and constantly changing what we're doing and crops we're putting in based on changing demand from our customers. Restaurants are always closing and opening. People's tastes change all the time. Menus change at these restaurants. And so to be able to keep that close, tight relationship with our customers has really been key.
Now, I'm thinking about the economics of your farm, and I'm wondering whether it's really possible to earn enough for a family to live on from just a third of an acre, and whether you could share some of your business model.
Well, the way I put it, it's school teacher wages, not doctor wages, but it's a fair living. We think about it is on a square foot basis. A third of an acre, the amount of land we have in production is 15,000 square feet. And so if we can sell $5 or $6 per square foot, then we're achieving gross sales of $75,000-$80,000 a year. And with some true business practice and what lean mindset, we can net around half. And so the key is to make sure we're putting in crops that can yield that. And we're, like I said, growing 2 or 3 crops per season per square foot. And so really we need crops that give us around $3 a square foot per harvest, which is achievable. A head of lettuce, for example, takes about a square foot and can sell for about $3 per head in most markets here. And it's the darn simplest crop to grow. Few pests want to come after it, and very little can go wrong with it. And we can grow 2 of those per season, per square foot. Now, you can mix in other crop, higher dollar value crops like cilantro and tomatoes and achieve a higher square foot income. The challenge is to cut out the waste. Notice when defect is entering into your production system. Every seed should turn into cash is the way we think of it. And that hasn't happened, then there's a problem somewhere. And it's about being disciplined and noticing when the waste of overproduction, excess motion. In Japan, the Toyota production system, they identified 7 types of mudas or waste. And those types of waste are very much present on farms as much as they are in any other work environment.
The last few decades have seen the growth of really very large farms. But before that, many people were producing food from their backyards, either for local markets or for home use. Do you anticipate a return to micro farming? And if you do, what do you think will drive that shift?
Well, you know what? University of Colorado study last year showed that if current trends continue, we'll have half as many farmers at the end of this century as we do right now. And farms at the end of the century will be twice as large. So we're on a fast track to gigantism here. So the headwinds are very strong. However, I'm hopeful because I've done trainings around the world. I've seen optimism. I've seen that people, especially the youth, want to eat better food. They recognize that the food they're given from the industrialized food system is crap. It's making them sick. Colon cancer rates in the U.S. Among young people are going through the roof. Obesity among young people is at epidemic levels here. And it's for our own health, not to mention for the sake of the environment, health of the environment, we need to make a change and pivot so that we put small farms at the center of our food system instead of pushed out to the margins.
Ben Hartman, the author of The Lean Micro Farm, bringing us to the end of this program. Thank you to all my guests. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations. And if you have, please do take a moment to share the podcast and do get in touch if you've got news to share. Our Newsweek podcast brings together a collection of the audio from recent 8.9 video interviews. If you want to watch instead of listen, then please visit our website at 8.9.com and click on the TV tab. More, as ever, on our website, 8.9.com, where you can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.